Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, guys, welcome back to the podcast. Going to get to Eddie Pepperell here shortly. Just wanted to note, this was recorded on Thursday night of Players' Championship Week. Eddie's run towards the championship title had not happened yet, which will become pretty obvious here pretty shortly, but just wanted to note that. We did not get a chance to talk to him after the tournament. Yes, enjoy the interview. Eddie is an incredible guest. We're very thankful we could have him on and appreciate his time as always, and thank you for tuning in. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. Second visit, first time in person. Mr. Eddie Pepperell, you're in a lot different position, I would imagine, in life, but definitely in the world of golf than you were the last time you were on.
Yeah, I was reminded on the way here of when we spoke 2 years ago. I was in Denmark, and what came to my mind was that week I had to play commando because I'd forgotten to pack any boxes, right, which is the first time it's ever happened. And the other reason I just thought of it, I don't know why I thought of it, is because I went to the golf club one day and Richard Bland said to me, Ed, you just need to be careful, because the hotel was like a U-shaped and you could see across the hotel. And he said to me, Ed, just be careful, because I saw you walk into the bathroom yesterday. And I could see with your naked ass.
Close your curtains.
Yeah. So, I've come a long way since then.
It's like the Standard Hotel in New York. It sits above the High Line. It kind of straddles the High Line. And, you know, people, like, there's no tint on the windows, so people have been caught doing things there. But then it's also very voyeuristic too. There's all sorts of people that book those hotel rooms and film stuff on the other side. Yeah.
I think this is a great opportunity to call him Dick Bland, not Richard Bland, which he should go by.
I don't think
way.
He saw. He would have needed some form of device to see it. But
we've got the European Max Homa on.
Yes, this is it.
Is that accurate?
Well, you've gotten kind of a reputation on Twitter, even more so on Twitter since you were last on. What's that been like, and kind of have you enjoyed kind of the higher Twitter profile and social media?
I don't mind it. I don't dislike it. Don't get me wrong. I feel like I've certainly of late, in terms of the last few months, I haven't, really tweeted very much at all, really. I respond a lot more now. I'm replying to a lot of tweets, but it is what it is. Yeah, I don't really try to do it for effect. You know, there's some things sometimes in my mind and I'll tweet, and other times I'll just leave it. But
you had some quotes about it this week, I think, at the first timers press conference here at the Players.
Yeah, I can't remember what I said. It was 2 days ago. But when I come here or wherever I go, people seem to talk of one of two or three things. It was historically either my blog or Twitter. People, the blog never gets mentioned anymore, nor does my golf. My golf never got mentioned, which is not surprising.
Which is an indictment of U.S. media.
Well, it's an indictment of how bad I am. It's an indictment of a few things, but I think the fact that I am kind of known for my Twitter and that type of stuff, and the various sound bites that may have come across the interviews isn't. I don't know. I don't know if it's so much a reflection of me as it is the rest of the world, or the rest of the media, or the rest of the lack of willingness.
Nobody else says anything.
Exactly. It's so bland that you mentioned being kind of hungover at the British Open and everyone just ran and went nuts with it.
Exactly.
And it's like not that big of a deal. Like, you're definitely not the first person to do that.
No.
You're just maybe one of the few people that would
and
stand
it's
up
not
and
the
say
best
it.
Round I've ever shot hungover either. So,
which is, that sounds like there's a story there.
Yeah, well, I can't remember it. I'm sure I shot a better one. I have. Kings Barnes, shot 6 under. I played the Dunhill Links with Kevin Peterson, who's a famous cricketer. And second day at Carnoustie, I was putting terrible. I snapped my putter on the third green. I had to play 15 holes at Carnoustie.
Was this year?
This was 2 or 3 years ago. Okay. This would have been 15, I think. Or 16. And I was 12 over through 10, putting with a lob wedge from the third onwards. And I honestly thought I wasn't going to break 90. And I think I shot 10 or 11 over and I birdied the last. I hit driver, 3 wood, and I tapped in from 4 feet with a 2 iron. And I was waving to the crowd. It was the best throw I've ever made. I had a few trick that night. And then played Kings Barnes the next day and shot 6 under.
Where'd you go? Was it the Dunvegan?
No, I think I was on my own. I wasn't on my own. I had a friend called Sheffy, big Sheffy. And me and him I had a fair bit to drink from memory. And yeah, I mean, we couldn't see.
You make the 54 hole cut?
No. Okay. I needed to have shot. It was 59, something like, PE line could have done, but no.
So filling in a bit of details for what we introed at the top of the show, you've won twice since in 2018 as it is. I want to kind of go back and revisit Qatar and winning there and kind of, and you wrote about on your blog, I know you think it's not being read anymore, but I still read it. And you wrote about kind of the perspective that came for, you didn't hit any drivers the week before in Oman, I think you wrote.
Yeah, no.
I think what was going on there? Just you were feeling a little blockage with the driver?
I was struggling, which I tend to do in the months of January to March. I think I've had one top five in my career from January to April. So,
and is that just because you're so tied into home base being England and you really put away the clubs from November, December?
Maybe. I kind of...
You truly have an off season?
I really switch off and then I come back and I'm definitely heavier and a bit bigger. And then my swing seems to be terrible for a few months and I figure it out. But... I was struggling in Oman. I think I remember tweeting something the week before Oman saying I'd figured it out. And by figuring it out, it was setting the ball up on the heel of the golf club. So I'd have to reroute the club somewhat so that my arms would come closer to my body at impact to hit, a great impact position. And this was a great idea. I had it figured out. And in practice, it was okay. And then my first tee shot with a driver in the tournament was the par 5 12th in Oman, and it's sea all the way up the left. There's loads of rocks, and the wind was quite hard off the left. So, first true test, and I snap hooked it straight into the rocks. It actually pinged off the rocks back into the fairway, and I made an easy four in the end. But I didn't pull my driver out once after that for the rest of the week. And yeah, that particular swing field didn't last very long. So, I wasn't in a good spot with my driver. But then I worked with a new coach the next week, and he gave me some doable, I would say, would be the feelings I had, but I still hit driver very few times in Qatar.
So what flipped then from Oman to Qatar?
Well, I stopped setting up off the heel and the new coach, basically, we just worked on my leg work and my hips and I had a feeling where I was just basically trying to, from the top of the backswing, get my left hip to kind of just go straight behind me. So it was a nice feeling, actually. I'd never had that before. It was always very, with my swing feels were always quite static. That one wasn't, and I drove the ball better for it. So,
because it was quite a route, and I know we talked about this a couple years ago on the podcast, but a route to a kind of up and down route to getting to where you are now. Because you were progressing, you were inside the top 100 in the world, and you lost your game and ended up losing your card, and then you found it shortly. Kind of after, you might be the best example of the No Laying Up podcast bump ever. You climbed over 300 world ranking spots in the time, but. Kind of your perspective on when you were struggling was always what I found really interesting. And I remember the story, you throwing a club up in a tree and stuff like that. With all you've been through, the ups and downs in your career, how much has your recent success really fulfilled you on a personal level?
I don't know. That's hard to answer. I mean, I definitely, my mood definitely swings with my golf, it wasn't something I wanted to happen or expected to happen, but it definitely did. And when I lost my card, I had some times where it was a bit difficult, and then, the good times it's the good thing with me is I don't ever get too low or too up. Like I'm fairly consistent, I would say, and I'm pretty level headed in many ways, emotionally, certainly, but it definitely swings somewhat, but to say I'm fulfilled by the good golf, I don't know. I mean, I only ever feel satisfied if things have gone well. I do have a feeling now and again of, real satisfaction. A couple of events spring to mind. The US Open in 2017 was a big one. I came 16th at Erin Hills, and that was a huge result at the time for me. Probably one of my best performances ever, to be honest, relative to where I was in my career. So, there's been various times where I felt hugely satisfied, and I get some fulfillment from that. But
in that context, how does the win at the British Masters stack up to Qatar?
Yeah, I mean...
And do you only win tournaments that are named the Masters?
We'll find out soon. That would be a shock.
Did that feel like a validation of sorts that you felt like you needed, or was it just a
not
bonus?
Not really. I mean, I remember the Scottish Open last year, I came second, but I was leading at one point and Brandon Stone shot a great final round to beat me. And I kind of felt like I did everything pretty much well enough to win that tournament. I was very comfortable being in that position leading, and I expected to win. And okay, I didn't win, but you know, it felt as good as, really. British Masters, as soon as I was playing really bad on the Wednesday, and then as soon as I shot 500 on the Thursday and got into a couple of swing feels, I kind of thought, well, knowing what historically has happened with swing feels in progression in tournament, I just could only see kind of good things for the rest of that week. And I just thought I was going to win the tournament straight from the Thursday, and I expected myself to lead all the way through, which I did. So, I mean, there was definitely my mentality had definitely come on somewhat from Qatar and obviously years gone by.
And as a follow-up to that, like very, very radically different courses and conditions.
Yes.
British Masters, it was pissing sideways the one
Sunday. Sunday was terrible. Yeah. Well, the weird thing is I didn't feel like I played amazing at the British Masters. You know, with Qatar, I hit the ball tee to green really well. So statistically, I actually lost on the greens that week relative to the average player in the field, and I still won. British Masters, I didn't hit the ball as well, but putted a little better. So it didn't, but I still expected that there was just something about the course and the way I was playing that there was a definite serenity and a calmness to it, you know, and I kind of felt like, yeah, I was pretty much in control. But that was satisfying. I mean, for sure, you know, but I don't really give much, I haven't historically given any credence or much to any event I've ever played in. So it's like this week, someone said to me, you know, what is it? Is this the fifth major? And I was like, well, of course it's not. I mean, not in my opinion. I would put Wentworth ahead of this event because for me, I've only really known Wentworth as being, in my mind, a bigger event because I've been part of it. And that's so, because I haven't got that kind of, whatever you want to call it, historical context or sense of tradition, you know, I struggle to kind of place them. So it just feels like if I'm playing good golf, well, you know, I can contend. And if not, it doesn't really.
Those two tournaments are always in the same conversation as the, you know, the potential fifth major, whatever that means. How would you compare them, having played in both?
I would say I'm going to give the Players' Lounge to Wentworth. Players' Lounge to Wentworth. Just roast dinner every day if you want it. Great service. They don't.
What does that mean? Roast dinner.
You don't have a roast dinner? That's like, well, meat, vegetables, potatoes, Yorkshire pudding. I mean,
versus gravy. What do they have here?
Well, actually, my girlfriend made me a lovely salad today. It's tuna. What's tuna that's kind of raw? Oh, it's
sashimi.
Yeah, sashimi. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Something like that. Don't get me wrong, it's good here, obviously. The thing is, you know, the ancillary stuff to an event, which doesn't really bother me, you know, like obviously this week you're given cars and the service is incredible. But, you know, I really like the feel of Wentworth. The golf courses are quite different, but both very testing. I mean, I've always thought Wentworth's a great course, but I've always felt quite uncomfortable on it. You know, this is obviously a great course. Yeah, it'd be tough to compare them, but the thing is, any event in America always kind of feels bigger. I mean, just because there's more people and there's more, you know, generally drunk people shouting things at you.
Well, and I think kind of what you're alluding to there too is on the European Tour, Wentworth is a elevated event in every sense. Like every event on the PGA Tour has a certain, you know, kind of floor to it, and the Players is slightly above that, but European Tour has such a wide variety. I mean, like the fields you'll get in Portugal and Sicily don't really represent kind of the cream of the crop for Europe. So it is like a very big, and maybe that, I think that probably was what the Players used to be like. It probably was a way bigger deal than some of the smaller tournaments in the 70s and whatnot. Yeah. But now every tournament's just got so much money behind it. It's hard to really get super jacked up for this event.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's something I would agree with. You know, that's part of what, I mean, I think we're overconsumed in every aspect of the word, you know, in terms of not just golf but any TV show or any kind of TV show. But how much do you have to get rid of to make the Players Championship attractive? How much do you have to get rid of to make majors attractive? Do you know what I mean? I think you have to get rid of a lot, and that isn't going to happen. That's always the argument I make with the Six Nations is the rugby. The Six Nations is a big deal, and it's actually happening at the moment. And I think it's a big deal because it's five matches a year. Like, people get up for that, you know, and that's what sport used to be. And I think we've lost that. And that's just, you know, to steal a phrase that isn't mine, that's the problem of progress, really, because it's just a sign of the times, a sign of success. But the ramifications, the unintended consequences of that, unfortunately, I think, is overconsumption and therefore lack of general interest.
Eddie, how have you changed your approach or your schedule since you've gotten in the top 50 in the world? Like, has there been a bigger impetus to play here in the U.S. just because there's just more money at stake, or how have you changed your schedule?
It's got nothing to do with the money. It's my schedule pretty much has written itself this year, because being top 50 at the end of the year, you know, gave me pretty much all the majors, the WGCs, and then access to four potentially PGA Tour events. If I want, I'm only going to play three. So I looked at it and it was just amazing, because I could play in the desert and then come to Mexico and play all the way through in America, apart from the British Masters, all the way through to Ireland. So obviously missing Qatar was, you know, it was a thing. I mean, I didn't want to have to do that, but when I'm playing definitely Mexico and definitely the players, the schedule would have been a nightmare to get to Qatar for last week and back here. And I said, listen, the only way I would do that, it would obviously take you being paid a lot of money to be, or being paid to money to be there. But when I know that the European Tour are in charge of that, there's no way I'm taking money from the European Tour. If some super rich guy wants to pay me some money to go somewhere, you know, I'd definitely consider it. But when it's coming out of the European Tour's pockets, then I couldn't bring myself to do that. So that pretty much was the definite no for me in that sense. And, you know, and then, yeah, the fact that I could play the Arnold Palmer was, why wouldn't you, you know?
Do you want to play the US Tour full-time? Is that a goal of yours?
No.
No, not at all.
No, it's not. I mean, if someone said to me now you could have this schedule for another decade, then I would absolutely take it, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing schedule I've got this year. I mean, I love playing in Europe. I've never historically traveled too well. I mean, I think I've traveled better in America than I have certainly in Asia and Africa for a number of reasons. But
what's your favorite part of the Euro Tour schedule?
Well, I always like the links. This year, the Irish, the Scottish and the Open. Can't wait to obviously do those. But also the end of the year. I mean, I've always tended to play better in September and October. But this year, well, we've got Dunhill Links, Wentworth, Portugal falls around that time, which is an event that I enjoy, practically a holiday. That's a nice time of year to be playing golf. Italy as well might be a bit later. So,
the Rolex Series.
Pretty much. I guess I've just pretty much given you the Rolexes. But there are, you know, things like KLM, which is in Amsterdam. I always play that. I always go to Czech and play that one. I mean, that's 1 million euros, you know. Yeah. That's less than what the winner picked up last week. But it doesn't really bother me. I've always had a good time going there.
It's cool that the BMW PGA is late.
Yes.
It's late in the year this year.
Yeah, it's going to be unbelievable, yeah. I think, yeah.
We interrupt this podcast for an important PSA from the Merch Czar. The ERC soft golf ball with the triple track technology is legit. Aren't the best innovations always the most obvious? I mean, of course, three massive straight lines on a golf ball will help me finally pick a line and actually stick to it. And I'll tell you what, keeping putts between the mustard and mayo en route to a classy one-putt bogey is a real thrill. So if you're looking to steal a couple strokes on the green, pick up a box of the ERC Soft Callaway Balls at CallawayGolf.com. And as always, tell them I sent you. And if you don't putt better, you can come at me on Twitter. It's NGShoeNLU. Now let's get back to this week's pod with Captain Solly Sollenberger and his sultry baritone.
I want to circle back to Qatar actually a little bit. There was two things I wanted to ask about that. I was watching the highlights getting ready for this, and even the broadcasters commented on you dealing with the nerves and how you looked nervous out there. What was going on internally for you trying to win your first event?
I wasn't that nervous. I mean, I unusually had it because I knew I had this new swing feeling. I've only ever really struggled under pressure because of a swing feel. I mean, I've got a theory that the reason Zach Johnson has more tournament wins than, say, Henrik Stenson is because of what he has to achieve and what he has to feel to achieve a good shot under pressure. I mean, things change. So depending on what you have to feel to produce a shot, I think has a huge impact on whether you do or don't produce it. All of a sudden, I had a feeling where I could rotate as hard and fast as I want and it would generally produce a good result. Well, I was excited for that because I've never had that. So I wasn't very nervous at all, you know. And the thing I've also found historically when you're in contention is the only thing that can make you nervous is a setback or something that happens that's unusual. So the thing that happened on the Saturday where I hit the rock and I fatted it three times, I mean, that's an unusual thing to happen and it can really throw you, it can just throw you. And I had a bit of that on the Sunday where I hit it right on 15, I had to pitch out. And all of a sudden, you know, there isn't the momentum of the round, you know, the rhythm has been upset. Sometimes that can, I think, have an effect. But
And on that particular moment, the broadcast was talking about the effect your caddy had in talking you into making that layup shot on 15. And you wrote on your blog as well about how big of an impact your caddy had on that. What specific way did your caddy like steer you home to that victory?
Well, he definitely got the club right on the last. I mean, I wanted to hit wedge. He had me hit 9, and that was a great shout. It was obviously a good decision chipping out on 15. I mean, the shot could have come off, but it would have been a crazy shot in hindsight with a 5-iron. I mean, it wouldn't have been a pleasant one to have to take on.
No laying up, though, right?
No laying up. That was the thing. part of the thing with having to chip out was that I kind of knew at the same time I've still got a 6-iron in. It's not like you've got a 9-iron in. I mean, it's kind of tough to get up and down with a 6-iron. I nearly did, but... And at that point in the round, actually, I was a fair few ahead. I mean, Ollie had a great finish to kind of put pressure on me, but, you know, at that time, I think I was probably 3 ahead. So, I felt like chipping out. It made a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to ask you to unpack the Henrik Stenson ZJ thing a little bit. Is Zach's swing more repeatable than Henrik? Is that why he's able to?
No, I think under pressure, things move differently, things feel differently, things move at different speeds, whether it's your arms or your body. When I watch Zach swing, I just have a feeling that he just rotates hard. I mean, he's got fairly strong club face, fairly strong grip, so he can probably just get to the top and think of rotating. Whereas if you're an arm swinger, which I think Henrik probably is in terms of his feels, I mean, I would say, it's not to say that you can't achieve great performances, of course, under pressure, but it's to say that on the long run, you know, it can be, worse of things can happen, I think, when you're having to think about your arms, when your body wants to move fast, because that's just what happens under pressure. So, you know, that was, that's my theory. I could well be wrong.
You got me in my head now. There's more variables.
I was going to say is how technical are you with your swing, and I always picture tour players like, you know, did they grow up and they were just so much more technical about their swings than I was? Because I didn't ever think of anything like that. And I'm like, maybe that's where
it went
wrong.
It's almost like
me.
A schism. Like you're either arms or body. Right?
Well, no, I'm just curious how technical you are. And if you're not, when it came into play, basically.
I mean, I never used to think about these things, but I think this is the thing, isn't it? If you want to get really, really good at something, it's hard to get there without having to, especially a game like golf, because I'm a believer that it's a game of skill, and so therefore you need great technique. So how do you improve your technique? You know, you either need to be guided down the right path, or you have to do it kind of yourself.
I tried just never practicing, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah,
so I kind of see what you're saying.
I probably play golf with 2 or 3 different swing feels, and I have done for the best part of 2 years. So I'm actually working with 2 coaches now. But the coach I worked with last
year. Freaking me out, man.
I'm afraid to ask what the swing feels are. Yeah,
well, no. I have a driver swing feel, and then I have a separate swing feel with a 3-wood. And I have a separate one with my irons.
It sounds like starting to sound like club pro guy here pretty soon.
Yeah, but I do. So with my driver, I only ever have 1 swing feel in, and I basically can't draw my driver.
What is the swing feel?
It's with rotation with my hips. I set the ball on the toe, and I try to rotate my hips.
And you're not going to turn your hands over?
The reason I set it on the toe is because I have a tendency to swing a little flat with my driver, and then as my hips fire, my kind of arms come further out in front of me on the downswing, so I basically middle it. So I know that's going to happen, but it allows me to keep rotating, and it's very anti-left feel, so I like that. The 3-wood is a re-root feel. That's why I have a super flat 3-wood. So basically, the heel never digs in, so the club face never turns over. So if I hit my 3-wood left, I have to put a terrible, terrible swing on it, which I very rarely do. My bailout with the 3-wood tends to be right. And my iron feels, I sometimes feel re-root, like I did at the British Masters, but on the Sunday I hit a lot of poor iron shots, particularly mid and short irons, because I know with that swing feel, my body can outrace my arms a bit. So I like to feel like my arms come down a bit more against my back and my chest with my irons. But that requires a better backswing. So I'm always kind of working on, with me, my iron play needs to be great if I'm going to win or come close to winning a golf tournament, because my statistics show that every tournament I've ever done well in, my iron play has been great. And I've never, ever done well in a golf tournament where my irons haven't been really good relative to the field. So.
What do you struggle the most with? What's the one shot or the one thought?
I basically can't draw my driver. I'm not very good at soft chips around the green with a lob wedge where you've got to loft it up.
God, you speak my language.
It really depends. I mean, like my short game, I had never practiced my short game, but statistically last year I was one of the better guys on tour with my short game. And that's because my short game, it correlates real close with my irons. So it's basically the same thing for me. So when my irons are good, my short game's good. And when my irons aren't good, my short game's kind of bad.
That was the whole Tiger release patterns thing, right? When everyone was making fun of his chipping.
Exactly.
He's like, no, I'm between release patterns. Like, no, come on, it's chipping. It's different.
Exactly.
It's
not. Also, on the iron putting front, how much of that is psychological? To where you're basically playing offense. Like you're putting for birdie. You're on the offensive instead of you know, scrambling to make pars. And
well, there's some of that with the putting. I've always felt like, yeah, I've probably held more par putts than birdie putts from particularly say 6 foot. That's probably true, and there's definitely some psychology in that. Probably
the stats show that professional golfers make a 6 foot par putt more than a six foot birdie putt. It's
yeah,
crazy.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
That makes me feel better and worse at the same time.
The whole Tiger thing was fascinating. You know, because I had a period a few years ago where I literally had I get the yips around the greens for like 2 weeks, and then it went, and I was like, I've always been a good chipper. And it was purely technical, and it literally is. You know, Tiger Woods doesn't just get the yips. I mean, the problem with the yips is people only see it when it's happening, and then they think that's a psychological problem, which at that point it is. But how did it start? It never starts as a psychological.
There's a big lead up.
It starts as a technical problem, and then it's like a monster. You know, everyone's got potential monsters in their pockets or on their shoulders, but it's small, and you have to keep them small. The best golfer on the planet is the guy with the smallest monsters. It's not the guy that doesn't have any. Every fucker's got monsters. It's just Dustin probably has a great handle on all of his little gremlins, whereas some guys doesn't.
It's crazy that you say that like that, because I feel like the last 2 or 3 years watching Jordan Spieth, he's made absolutely everything, but like the grip's crazy and he's cross-handed and all that. And like he's making everything and he looks super comfortable with it, but I can tell there's a monster on his shoulder.
Yeah, it does look like he's playing with a monster on his shoulder now.
He's just like he's just trying to fight off that monster.
Yeah.
For as long as possible, and now he's finally dealing with that monster, and he's going to be good when he gets to the other side of the monster. But
yeah, you know. I mean, yeah.
So what's your biggest monster?
Well, historically it was my driver. So you know, and I'm gradually. The thing is, also the hardest thing with golf is that monster can grow so fast, so big, so fast, and trying to shrink him. I mean, it's just a fucking shit show.
When you know, it probably gets bigger when you're trying to shrink it.
Possibly, or what probably happens is it actually doesn't. But other monsters get bigger because you're not focusing on them. And then...
Aren't you... Like, this is like life. Like, I know we're talking about golf, but this is really
golf
just
is life.
Yeah.
Golf is life.
For sure.
I'm in your front room and there's just flags everywhere. Golf is life.
I mean, I'm saying we could change some of these words and we could be having a self-help podcast on a different topic.
Absolutely.
You're giving me anxiety.
Tron's monsters are growing as we're speaking right now.
But that, anxiety, that's funny you bring that. You know, that only ever correlated with bad technique for me. You know, I would struggle to sleep when I was hitting my driver off the planet. You know, I never, ever go to bed worrying about, let's take Sawgrass. I will never go to bed worrying about the third hole. It's a mid-iron. I'm generally very good with my mid-irons. I will never worry about that. But if you say, would I potentially be worried about the 18th tee shot if it's hard into off the left? Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, potentially. You know,
16 being like I'm sure 16 this week is exceptionally tough for you because
I'm
you don't
three
draw
wood.
Your
I'm
you don't draw
wood.
Your driver. No. You're hitting three wood and you're laying back a little bit. But
I hit a three wood there yesterday over 300 yards. You know, I went in there with a three iron. So the three wood I've got is super strong. So that's why I've got a super strong three wood. So don't get me wrong, it gives me holes elsewhere in the bag. It doesn't really matter because I'm filling up the holes in the area of the game where I feel like it gives me most comfort, you know, and so yeah.
Just because I think people are way into the equipment stuff, can you talk through your bag setup and how you picked? Like, that's really interesting. Is, you know, I have a really strong three wood because basically you want to hit it both ways off the tee is what you're kind of
I mean, my ping.
So what you go from driver three wood to
driver this week? Driver three wood to three iron. I always play with four wedges, so. I'm always lacking a five wood or a two iron or something like this, which, you know, I've noticed the last couple of weeks, it definitely would have been beneficial to have a five wood. But
have you found it's a bigger deal on this side of the pond
so far,
because it's softer and because it's more target golf.
Yeah, I mean, five would have come in probably a couple times today, not just into the par fives. My ping driver, I mean, the reason I've got it in play and the reason I keep going back to it is because it's got a lot more spin on it. It's super safe. I mean, it's the amateur's version. It's not even the lower, it's not even the LST G400. It's like what you'd buy off the shelf, but I'm kind of happy with that. I mean, you know, generally speaking, hit very few bad ones with it, and it's a very safe club. My three wood's the complete opposite. I want my three wood to go as fast with as little spin as possible. It's a different swing feel. I've got a different history. So they're two completely different clubs, and my irons are, you know, somewhere in between. Yeah,
I'm curious, kind of now that you're at this elevated, you know, level of golf, and you're playing in these events with all these huge names, do you find yourself looking around a little more, looking down the range at the people you're playing with, and kind of being amazed, or do you feel like you truly belong here?
Oh no, my problem isn't looking at other people on the range. My problem is like what happened today on the 18th green. I've got a 20-foot putt to read, and there's a big TV screen next to the green showing the golf, and I'm just stood there watching the golf. So that's my problem. I watched the golf, you know, and I kind of enjoy doing that. But I couldn't give a monkey's, like, you know, I've never seen Bubba hit a ball. I don't think I've seen Tiger hit a ball. I walked past Rory in Mexico, hit a driver. He was carrying it 390. I thought, fuck this. I don't really care about the other guys, you know.
What drives you and what drove you? What motivated you? Is it an inward perfection, or because I think a lot of guys would, you know, they watch a ton of golf and, you know, they see Tiger and you know, are chasing certain guys.
Randy's still talking about life, by the way. Not
I know. I'm like, I guess we can couch this in golf terms if you want, but
no. I always feel bad about answering this question this way, and I think it's. I just don't want to be poor, and I'll say that not because being poor is a bad thing, right? I'm not trying to make that statement. But what I'm saying is having felt what I've felt, now having had some of the success I've had and certainly having earned some of the money I've earned, and I knowing what it's afforded me in terms of many things in my life, I kind of want to keep that. You know, I don't want to go back to where I once was. And so, you know, honestly, I've only ever felt most driven off my worst failures or my worst feelings, you know, whether it was my accountant calling me up after Q school and I just turned pro to say I was in debt and I needed to find some money, or whether it's really struggling after, say, for 2 months and not being able to hit a drive, you know, these kind of things, or losing my card. That's where I tend to get my motivation. And the problem with that is that it isn't sustainable in many ways. And when I'm at a position like now where I've had some good success for a while, you know, how motivated can I be? But the one good thing that did happen that I will say last year is once I started reaching higher levels and higher standards, I kind of kept motivating myself. Actually, I was finding some motivation within myself.
What was the new motivation?
To stay at that level, to keep being at that level.
Did you pick specific stuff, or specifically?
It was specifically probably with my iron play and the ability to say hit a 7-iron or 6-iron exactly the way I want to hit it, dead straight.
And that wasn't statistically based. That was just feel based. Like it was you versus yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I know what the ability to do that gives me in terms of the stats and the results. So I know it's important for me, but and so that's partly what drives that. But yeah, you know, once I got in 2017, I got so good with my irons and it was so effective, and to a degree last year at similar weeks as well, that I know that's my DNA. So that's given me motivation. All of a sudden, that's one thing that the stats have helped me with, actually. It's just able to have in some form of identity. You know, I sound like I should be part of the LGBT society there, but
sets your high watermark.
I've got an identity.
I finally have a home.
I've got a home. 6-iron.
So you say you obviously really enjoy watching golf, right? On the 18th green today, you know, I'll just watch golf. But I'm fascinated. Do you watch golf for the players, or do you watch golf for the game itself? And I know that might not be the best question. It reminds me of, I've been around some basketball coaches, mm-hmm. and they'll watch film and they'll watch games, and they are truly just watching the game. Like it doesn't even, they just recognize the players by numbers. It doesn't even really matter who the players are necessarily, mm-hmm. that they're watching the game for the sake of the game.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if that's, I'm just fascinated, you know, huge golf fan, you watch a lot of golf, and then when you get out there, it's like, oh, I've never seen Bubba or Tiger. It's, you know, it doesn't really
that's a fair point, actually. I mean, I wouldn't stop by, you know, I certainly wouldn't stop by to watch these guys hit balls on the range. So I guess that kind of answers your question to a degree. But I guess what I like when I watch golf is, well, iconic holes or particular shots or a particular swing. It could be anybody that's got a great move. It would be the move, you know, and I guess I would relate that to the basketball point in terms of the pattern, the historic pattern. If I see someone move somewhat remotely like Ben Hogan, I'm going to tune in. Cameron Champ, I'm going to tune in because it's like there's an incredible action happening here, and I kind of want to be part of that. So obviously it comes back to the individual, but it also, I guess, relates somewhat to a pattern or a move or something, you know, historic in a way, if that makes any sense.
Do you think professional golf over the last 5 to 10 to 20 years has gotten homogenized then in that regard? And you see less of those unique swings or less of those things that make you want to tune in?
Possibly. However, you could probably watch all the golf swings of, say, the 70s, and not only do they wear great trousers, but they, you know, all their left feet generally come up off the ground and they stamp back down with their left knee, and there's a lot more lag, there's a lot more, you know, whatever, and it looks different. But they probably all kind of done that back
pretty
then.
Much the same,
so it's like, it's easy to say, well, the modern era is whatever it is, what it is, all the same. But actually, maybe the 70s was all the same. I mean, maybe the 40s was all the same. You know, sometimes you have to have that wider perspective, and that's probably true, because I would think that way of many, not just golf, of many, many things, you know, that happen in life.
Who was your favorite player growing up?
Sergio.
Sergio.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Shot making, you know, pure shot making.
You mentioned something about watching golf on the 18th green, but you also had you tweeted something a couple of weeks ago about watching golf here in the U.S. So for people that don't know the difference between kind of how golf is presented on TV in the U.S. and
actually, we have to take a commercial break right now. Sally, that's a great question.
Tron, settle down, Tron.
You guys, I'm going to walk into the room.
Tell us about what your experience was. Is this your first time watching golf on TV in the U.S.?
No, I have watched it before. It wasn't just watching. I mean, it wasn't just the golf, you know. That's why I didn't specifically refer to the golf. I actually said TV in America. And I was watching a film, I think it was The Accountant, which I love. I've seen it once. But now, because I've been in America 3 weeks, I've actually seen The Accountant, I think, on 5 different occasions now. And I've only seen the film twice.
Is that with Ben Affleck?
Yeah. I think I've watched it in 3 hotel rooms. One, I watched it in the Fairmont in Austin. And I mean, it was a break every fucking 8 minutes or something. You know, I'm just like, well, how are you supposed to watch this film?
Late stage capitalism. Mm-hmm.
And then
that's Randy's scene.
And then obviously you get to the golf, and it's like, I did tune in, and there was literally 2 shots shown between commercials, and I just kind of thought, it's just bad. It's just bad. You know, if you want to watch the golf, I mean, it is.
Well, what's it like in the UK?
It's not as bad as that.
Yeah.
I mean, people were saying, oh, it's the same. No, it's not the same. It's not the same. At least in the UK, they go back to the studio. They're filling it with some form of analysis by, you know,
So in the UK, are you getting the same feed?
I think you are. I think we get the same feed.
But you just have less commercials, but they're filling it with something
else?
It depends. So the bigger events, you'll have a separate feed. They'll have their own crew on site.
There's like an international feed on that.
Yes. And then for the smaller events, you'll get a feed that is just straight, like sometimes I would...
You watched this for 3 years, right?
So when I lived in Holland, I would, like for the Masters, the announcers would be in Dutch. Like all the local, like... announcers were there in Dutch, and I imagine it's the same in the UK, but the smaller events, it was just, I would hear Jim Nantz pipe straight into my TV.
That's a good point, actually. And the hardest events to watch in the UK are the smaller PGA Tour events, but I can guarantee the Players' Championship in the UK will be great coverage. Yeah. You know, they've got their own team, probably their own cameras, possibly, but the biggest events, like you just said, they'll be great to watch in the UK.
So you have you have Brownie, Radar.
Ken doesn't work for
Beamer.
It'd be Radar and Beamer and those guys.
But the European events, so like when it sticks out so much, because when they go to commercial in the States, like the international feed will come on and they will go to the opposite side of the golf course, and you will see Kevin Tway hitting his
like something out, some completely out of left field.
It has no context at all. It's not like a crazy good shot. Mm-hmm. It's not like a noteworthy moment in the event, but it's like they're just showing you golf instead of commercial. And it's like, yeah, coming back to here and seeing that. So really, I just wanted somebody other than our voice on this podcast talking about this. That it's
Eddie, do we like those bigger PGA purses? Or I can't help if these are maybe related.
Of course, this is the thing, isn't it? But
at some point, it's not sustainable. Well,
and that's exactly how it feels to me. There's just a feeling I have, and I don't know this stuff because I'm not clever enough. But the feeling I have is that how is this sustainable? Like, you know, actually. There can't be, I mean, people say TV drives money, but I can't believe there's enough people watching to actually drive that anymore. So what's driving it? It's the illusion that the TV still drives, or whatever. It's probably possibly more than that.
It's also called Tiger coming back healthy.
Okay.
And putting a Band-Aid on the broken leg.
Right.
Kind of thing. And then at some point they're squeezing the life out of something And the core audience is dying.
Well, so the future is surely some form of streaming service or the way TV's gone and all these, you know, Netflix, whatever. I mean, that's surely the future or a sort of future. But to my mind, is so bad for golf. And this is why, if we can talk about golf moving forward for a bit, because I have times where I'm kind of optimistic because we have an aging population and that's great for golf. But I also have times where I think, well, hang on, the average baby boomer is now beginning to retire. They still have all the money. You know, golf, is specifically the PGA Tour, is entirely...
The next 3 to 5 years still are...
I think we're okay, but... When there's a wealth distribution, or when there's a redistribution of the wealth, what does that look like? I cannot believe for a minute that there's enough people in my generation who are remotely interested in golf. So the economic future of golf, I kind of think, is dire on a number of fronts. But then I'm kind of think, well, there's maybe reasons to be somewhat optimistic.
So I was talking about it today, actually, with somebody, and the fact that the future is the streaming services and all that, and it's kind of leaning into that niche audience, but serving a very enthusiast audience, the people that are diehard golfers. And then the PGA Tour's marketing efforts and social media efforts and digital efforts have gone the complete opposite direction to where...
That's what I was going to say. I think the hardest part for this, and I know I'm with you. I'm like, I don't know. I'm sure there's 50 million moving pieces that I have no idea, you know, are in place. But to me, it's like, okay, golf seems like the most expensive sport to televise. It seems like the sport that would be the hardest, most complicated thing. And now it also seems like it needs to be propped up by this audience that is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and these core people who are going to sit and watch, you know, sit and watch these 45 events throughout the season. Because, you know, the Masters isn't going to struggle for ratings. The Masters could go full streaming tomorrow and it would be awesome. Could, you know, the FedEx St. Jude Classic go all streaming tomorrow? Like, probably not. That would probably be a horrible thing.
Bleed out those core fans. Like, cool, who's going to be watching those other 30 tournaments a year?
And that's where I'm kind of looking at. It's like the sum of all the parts is kind of what makes everything go. And I don't know. It's an interesting
talking about it from a larger perspective. Like, what other trends do you see? Really, I think it's instructive because our audience is largely US based. Mm. What trends do you see in the UK, or what do you see internationally?
Well, I mean, to my mind, the one good thing that golf's managed to do by keeping the European Tour and the PGA Tour is it's avoided the whole merger and acquisition craze that has happened in the last 10 years, like across all businesses, you know, and all things. And that, don't get me wrong, it's great for guys like me at the top, but I am also very much aware that at some point it's not. And this was the big thing that I had against the Phil and the Tiger match, is that to me, it's not that that's right or wrong. It's just that it's not kind of wise. It's just not kind of wise to have a guy earn $9 million in 4 hours, because do they not realize the level of resentment that causes and creates among the wider population? And, you know, there's a good book, and it, without me getting too apocalyptic, it's called... It's called The Great Leveler, and it's written by a historian, I think, and I haven't read it all, but I know the gist of it. And basically, there are only ever four outcomes when inequality gets so bad, and we're not there yet. But not one of them is in any way desirable. I mean, they're all terrible, terrible things. And
they affect everybody.
Oh, and they affect everybody. Yeah. In fact, the worse than that, they affect the rich the most. I mean, this is why it's not wise to be gloating about the fact you've earned $9 million in 4 hours, and not that Phil did or not that Tiger did, or I haven't got anything against either of the individuals.
But
I think
on a
they're
macro
great.
Level.
But the perception of it is, I just don't think it's great. And so I kind of can't detach myself from that feeling that I have. And that's the feeling I have from everything I've read or what I've learned. And I could be wrong, and I hope I am. But I'm aware that I'm also profiting and benefiting from the way things are, and things could get even better for me, you know, in the next 5-10 years. But I don't know. I kind of feel
so. Like, how do you separate those things?
I was going to say you wrote about that last year, actually, after, you know, you came into a lot of money after winning the Qatar Masters, and your runner up finish at the Scottish Open was actually your biggest paycheck last year.
Yeah,
the race to Dubai, or the Rolex Series is a very real thing. You kind of wrote about kind of going out and buying. There it is, right there. You wrote about going out and buying, spending £10 on some chocolates and feeling kind of ridiculous about that, or kind of struggling with the balance of, you know, I'm very well off now. I've earned this, but have I earned this? Kind of, can you? I was wondering if you could kind of expand.
I mean,
on
it
that.
Kind of, I wouldn't say it cripples me, but it definitely is something that crosses my mind quite regularly. You know, for sure. I could switch off from it, and you could just say it's the way it is. But I kind of, you know, I don't like that either. Really, I mean, there is an element of that for sure. But I don't know. I just,
how does it square up with how you were raised? Like, were you raised in, like, what was your upbringing? And
I think generally speaking, and in fact, this is the great, the UK and Europe is, I would say, definitely more egalitarian than over here, right? And that's not right or wrong. This is just philosophical differences, especially around money, between the two continents. When I tweeted the thing that I tweeted about the Tiger and the Phil match, and I called it pathetic, which is the only word I regretted in that tweet, I tweeted it at a time because I was in the Maldives, and everyone, thanks to Rolex, I was enjoying myself in the Maldives. And
were you in one of those like those little rooms on stilts?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, literally. We were in the sea. It was pretty nice actually. Although, yeah, I mean, I paid for it. I didn't get a free trip, you know, thanks to the Saudis. But what was I going to say? Yeah, I tweeted that, and everyone in the UK was asleep, and everyone in the UK and the US was up. So everyone in the UK was asleep, everyone in the US was up. And I got so much heat immediately, and I was like, oh my God, am I like well off on this opinion? Like, I'm conscious, am I like made? And then once everyone started waking up in Europe and the UK, almost unanimously everyone agreed with me. And it was it just highlighted to me the massive and the enormous cultural differences between the US and the UK and Europe, particularly surrounding money. And yeah, I think naturally I'm going to be that way more inclined. It's not to say I'm a bloody communist, because I'm not, but it's to say that, I don't know, something just doesn't quite feel right when there's this much disparity.
Well, I think that speaks to the difference between PGA Tour golf and European Tour golf, though, and it being a true like entertainment product here. It is so commoditized. Is that the word?
How do you say it? Kind of the Tiger effect too, right?
Like, but it's so commercialized, and it is like it is squeezed out to the absolute max. And European Tour just has so much, I don't want to say luxury, but the ability to be so flexible in where they go, and it's just a wider range of possibilities. And over here, it is so commercialized, it's so sponsored, it is so heavily influenced by the, you know, the people that make that sign the checks.
Yeah.
That it now I'm kind of, we have this conversation all the time. It's like, I don't know what we're watching. Like, I want to watch like really pure golf, but at the same time, like, I just want to see somebody hit it in the water 4 times on 17. Like, it's just entertainment.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Someone asked me the other day at the first time as press conference whether I had any advice for the US Open and setting the course up. And I was like, well, listen, let me tell you, last year I've never had so much fun watching all the pros have a nightmare at Shinnecock.
God, you're speaking to a very friendly audience.
So Eddie, I was like, I'm not going to sit here now as someone who's going to play in this event and tell you they should set it up because Eddie Pepperell
and wants
to have more fun.
How boring was Sunday when they put all the pins in the middle of the greens? And
exactly.
Like,
exactly. Yeah. Saturday was by far the most fun day to watch at the US Open last year when everyone was losing their shit, right? We get paid well enough money to have to experience that 5 times a year.
Especially when it's not their organization putting that
on. Exactly. And I just kind of thought to myself that question, well, you know, no, I mean, they can set it up however they want. And actually, in terms of an entertainment product, it was great. I mean, people like to see people suffer, you know? I mean, one of my favorite quotes is, everyone is waiting for the end of the... Somewhere deep in their hearts, everyone is waiting for the end of the world to come. I mean, it's a nice saying. It's from The Big Short, which is another apocalyptic film that I like, which is second, actually.
Randy has radar lock on you right now.
Yeah, can I... Couple of things. One, I need to point out the irony that we're talking to Eddie from England, who, lamenting how much more egalitarian, the UK is right now than the US, which I love.
Oh, we're going to have
scones. From a historical standpoint, my only point, because
Oh no, it was definitely okay. No, I was including Europe in that. I was including Europe.
I'm not backing you down. Yeah, yeah. No, Europe. No, for sure. I just want to point that out. But I do think there's something to. I think, you know, European tour golf, British golf. You know, we went to Scotland is so much more egalitarian than
it's like watching American PBS golf. Versus watching network TV. Like, if you feel like you're going to learn something and you're going to be entertained a little bit, and you're going to see 56 minutes of programming per hour versus 28 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. But I also the point you kind of touched on there, and I think, you know, if the tour is going to set itself up as an entertainment product, then I, as a fan, am going to treat it as an entertainment product. And so one of my big things is I kind of get on Ricky Fowler, and it's nothing against him personally, but it's almost this storyline that I've created, and it makes golf more fun for me.
Well, that's my whole thing. If it's going to be an entertainment-only product, it needs to get a fuck ton more entertaining, basically. It's
like right now, they want to have it this way, but yet they produce it, and everything about
sterile
it is
possible
this way. Yeah, and it's like, you know, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
No. That reminded me of my Twitter and talking of creating storylines. That's all I did with anal beads.
Which was sweet.
Makes Twitter more fun for me. None of it's true.
Well, I want to hear about the content committee.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Oh, well, I definitely can't say what I said. I just can't. In fact, I did a thing with Henny on Golf TV last week, and she asked me to tell her a joke. And I said, well, I mean, it's going to have to all be bleeped out. You know, and again, I can't tell this joke because it's, even to a US audience.
We can bleep it if you
know. No, you might know who it is, and it just, yeah, I mean... The content committee was a lot of fun, though.
We'll put that behind the paywall.
Yeah. How did that come together? And did you like write a script for that? How many takes did it really take?
Script was written.
Okay.
I just knew that I had one piece where I could say what I wanted, and it was going to be bleeped out.
And Gibbo is basically doing the production on
Gibbo, Tom Greaves, and one or two others. I mean, so you know, you've obviously met them. Yeah. Fucking great people, and a lot of fun. So, yeah, it was good.
Is there going to be more of those?
I think they're going to extend a couple of the storylines, like keeping up with Duffy. But I mean, not saying definitely that one, but you know, those ideas that were on the board, they definitely didn't put a couple of things into the original scene. I think actually, and I remember thinking, why haven't they put that in? Because that was funny. I think they're doing it to keep it back for what potentially could lead off. So it could, I think, but so
a roundabout question sort of related to that, but how would you sum up how are the demands on your time when you're at a tournament? And where I'm getting at with that is, I think everybody likes to say, oh, the European tour gets these guys because, you know, they're blah, blah, blah. They're paying them appearance fees. They're doing this. The PGA Tour, all these guys would say no to these kinds of videos. They just don't have time, blah, blah, blah. So I'm curious how the demands on your time are broken up during a tournament.
Before you answer, I would argue it's the opposite. Oh, like the reality is the opposite.
The European guys don't get paid.
No, well, like you may get an appearance, or like the U.S. guys going over there get an appearance fee. But
No. I'm saying like the U.S. players at Bay Hill are not getting an appearance fee. So yeah, when they go up,
they're having to deal with a bunch of bullshit.
But when they go up and they say, Justin Thomas, we need you to come do this ask. He's like, dude, I'm trying to win a golf tournament. Like I and the perception is Eddie, you know, or Justin Rose or whatever, you know, we're paying you six figures to be here. So you're kind of at our disposal.
But there's a trust level with the Euro Tour guys. Too, when Gibbo asks you to do something, you're more predisposed to do it.
There's a strong relationship, I would say. Gibbo has a good relationship with lots of the, certainly older guys than myself. So there's that. I mean, I think most of the European guys now are pretty on board. And I mean, there's been a lot of stuff done now. I think we kind of know, well, the tour wants to be somewhat.
The concept's been proved.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, there are definitely some players who aren't that keen on it. And there are some that are, you know. I think the tour have been quite good at identifying who and who isn't and using them in different ways. But I mean, you know, the demands for my time have gone up a little bit, but not terribly.
You ever feel pressure to
I
say
don't
no
get
to
paid
things,
six or, figures to be the only demands I have is the odd bit of chocolate in the room.
Can I do a rapid fire European tour thing? Like, how do you feel about the shot clock masters?
I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
No.
I remember seeing that on Twitter and thinking, God, Eddie, we disagree on something finally.
Well,
why didn't you like it?
For golf to take 2.5 hours, my big thing with the issue with slow play is if people have a big issue, if people think golf can take 3 hours, 2.5, if they think they can play, well, there's going to have to be a completely different kind of game. And I actually don't think, I mean, if you want golf to change, great, change it the way cricket changed. Maybe it'd be good for the game. I don't know. I don't know if it would. I think you would dilute it somewhat. So what are you going to do by changing? I mean, you're going to, a round's going to go from being 4.5 hours to 4 hours. Well, 4 hours is still a long time.
But so on some level, though, I feel like you guys are, we're speaking relatively, because the rounds on the European tour are far, like, I would venture to say far quicker.
They feel faster. Yeah.
Yeah. They feel faster and they're like, you know.
But they're still not, they're still 4 hours.
They're still not
4 hours, but they're not 4:45 or 5 hours.
Oh, but sometimes they are. I mean, I've played around at demos 5 hours and it wasn't because, I mean, it was just, it depends on the course, the conditions.
I was going to say, what's the root cause of that? Just the conditions?
The difficulty of
course
and the conditions. Yeah. I mean,
and then, to piggyback on that, how do you guys deal with, like, is there a different mechanism for dealing with slow play on the European tour versus the PGA tour that you've noticed?
I mean, we are probably, some guys in Europe are probably more ready to call out a few players for it. There really aren't many slow players in Europe, in my opinion.
And is that just because there's more peers?
I think there's been more pressure put on them. By not only by the guys, but also by the tour. I mean, you know, some of them have been fined quite heavily and they're not necessarily earning loads of money. So, you know, it's, there's definitely a push from the tour.
I hear what you're saying. I was out at the players this morning and watching and was paying a specific attention to this and was kind of like, okay, how slow are these guys playing? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, man, the caddies are hauling ass. They're going to the next tee. These guys are, they're kind of, like, none of these guys feel like they're playing slow at all. And I'm like, maybe it's just hard to televise because it just,
it's not
it takes
an enjoyable
4 hours.
Stroll.
It takes four
I mean, it's
and
not like
hours.
We're just, yeah. I'm probably the slowest walker on tour. Like, I have a very slow walk. But, I mean, yeah, around a golf course, I can't remember the last time I walked around a golf course thinking, oh, this is just a nice little stroll. And we do, you know, people generally do, yeah.
Well, that's the thing, too, is with, you know, everything that's happening in golf is making it slower. Like building tees, you know, 100 yards further back means a further walk back to the tee. Then you got to retrace those same steps to get to the next ball. And you do that on repeat for however many times.
Faster greens.
That's not time that you're going to get back. And it's so that, I don't know. I'm kind of with you on the slow play thing. I think it, you know, it's an issue. And I think it's mostly guys that are not ready to play when it's their turn and don't act quickly is the issue. But like, It's just hard when it gets windy and greens get crispy, like the 4-footers are way different and people have to grind over them and you miss them and you got another comebacker and it's like...
Yeah, I mean, would this narrative have played out the same way if the coverage was different or there were more cameras on the course? Yeah. You know, if you could just show...
shifting from shot
if
to they shot
were shifting,
to shot.
If the European Tour didn't just show six guys on a Thursday, I don't know if the narrative would be the same or if the... You know, if there were more cameras showing more, you could, flick and so... I just think it's a narrative that's been played out and it's trendy and it doesn't mean that it's true necessarily or the number one problem facing golf.
How would you react if you were like, I do want to single the guy out, but I feel bad doing, I don't want to put you in a shitty spot, but like JB Holmes, like if you were in the final group with him and he's taken close to two and a half minutes to hit an approach shot, like how would you handle that? From a psychological perspective on your own side, and then B, after the fact.
It's probably, I don't know, later on with a bottle of wine on Twitter.
It's the same way Tron handles it.
That's how everybody handles it. Yeah.
A couple quickly before we're gonna head to dinner here shortly. But I want to know what you think of the new rules. Have they had any effect on you? Do you think they're dumb? Do you think they're worthwhile?
I've had a sore back for a while anyway, so the amount of drops I took in one round in Saudi Arabia didn't help.
How was Saudi Arabia?
The worst thing that happened in Saudi that week, though, was it?
Was Saudi Arabia?
Oh, I wouldn't go. I didn't love it.
Yeah.
I didn't love it, no. By any stretch. It was boring, you know. A big part of my enjoyment of golf tournaments honestly comes down to the hotel, the food, and the social side of it, you know, like that's the big thing, obviously, that's different in Europe. I mean, I always like to socialize at night, glass of wine or whatever, and that adds so much to the experience of being a golfer on tour, you know, than going in your hotel, having your car, going in your hotel room. I mean, it's just, I couldn't live like that. So it was none of that. It was like a player's lounge a week and whatever. I mean, but
on the rules.
The rules. I mean, like anything, I think they're all put in with good intentions. I can't believe for any moment that anyone thought they were bad ideas. It's just, as with everything, any policy that gets put in place, something happens that you don't foresee, and it makes the rule look, or the law, whatever, look foolish. And that's clearly what's happened. But you know, I know I tweeted about them being cantankerous old men that you know, play the game, but I just, because I didn't want to tweet anything about women.
Please don't stop tweeting. I know you seem a little frustrated by it, but it is a breath of fresh air. Yeah. So,
what? Which of the new rules most frustrates you? Or which one do you think needs to be changed?
Well, I mean, the whole Hal Tongan and the Denny McCarthy thing was just so blatantly not enhancing his, or giving him any advantage, that to penalize him was just stupid. I mean, it's obviously stupid. So probably that one comes to mind, yeah.
I think for me, it gets back to when you see that happen, and cool, like the USGA and the RNA want to make things more intent-based, and then you see a guy anchoring his putter on his chest. I'm like...
Well... Yeah, I mean, I only anchored it 3 or 4 times today, so we'll leave that one, Tron.
All right, we got to run. Thanks, Eddie, for coming by. It's great to have you back on, and congrats on all the success, and best of luck the rest of the week.
Thanks, appreciate that. Yeah,
cheers.
I was going to make a joke about having my boxes this week. I mean, I wonder what we're going to talk about in 2 years' time.
You can make whatever content committee joke you had, and we'll just play it out. We'll play the outro music right over top of it.
Yeah, I could. Ba-ba-ba.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything.